This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley, and here's what party conventions sounded like in the 20th century.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
The work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
To look at how conventions have changed, how they haven't, and if some historic phrases have been shouted out from the stage this year, I'm joined by Michael Goldman and Julian Zelizer. Michael Goldman is a political strategist, and Jason Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian Zelizer and Michael Goldman, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I want to talk with you, Professor Zelizer, because the question that comes up every year, and I think some of it may be based on whether the networks cover it or not, do the conventions really matter?
Yes, they still do matter. They don't matter in the same way that they did before the 1970s, but they are still important moments when voters see the candidates make a national speech, which is one test that we use to gauge how someone will do in office. It is still a moment when the parties showcase up-and-coming talent, and it's still an important moment for the delegates and party operatives who are there for everything from fundraising to simply interacting with each other and having a moment to discuss strategy. So they're very different than they used to be, and you can argue there's many parts of it that are now irrelevant or could be changed, but I do think they still have a function.
So Michael Goldman, by Julian Zelizer's criteria, showcasing candidates, national speeches, voters getting to see, you know, what their presidential candidate looks like in action. Conventions are still relevant from your perspective, are they?
Well, I didn't go this year, and it's the first year I haven't.
Was that a comment right away?
Yeah, and I, you know, the idea having actually been in Charlotte. More than once, that the idea of going down there for a convention with a lot of people in a small place did not exactly make me excited. I think that part of what Julian said is true. I think there is a place for some piece of this puzzle. I'm not sure it's ever going to be the way it's never going to be the way it was before when I was a kid growing up in the 50s, even in the 1960 convention where they covered it all day. That's gone. There's too much infomercial, I think, and the responsibility of the networks to cover, I think, has been diminished dramatically. I don't think that's a good thing. I think if you're going to give people, a limited number of people, the power to have stations, the least they should have to do is cover once every 4 years, you know, a few days of a convention. But I do think that the problem is that everything is so scripted, everything is so timed, the idea of a surprise is really limited. And I think a lot of people got 54 choices, and a lot of people watched, and I don't want to get her name wrong because I have not seen the show yet, but is it Baby Boo Boo or whatever they call
it? I know what you mean.
More people saw that than saw the Republican convention on cable. And, you know, I guess the consumers are saying they don't want it anymore.
Well, aside from toddlers and tiara stars, as you're referencing, let me ask if whether surprise, you know, has to be. I mean, that was the guide. That was the thing that we judge these things by. Is there going to be a surprise? There's no more surprise. I have to say that I wonder if it's okay for it not to be a surprise. If it's okay, I want to get both of your responses to this, for them to be a big old ad. Because you know what? Half the people have not been paying attention. So for what we're all maybe bored with or we've heard over and over again leading up to this point, lots of folks are barely now just tuning in to get even the first blush of what the Republicans are trying to say their message is and the Democrats. So Michael,
I'd like to hear Julian's sort of call on this in the sense that I think the debates are much more important now than the conventions.
Okay.
I think people see the conventions as infomercials. What you're looking for, which is to compare and contrast, I think you can do that incredibly well. And we will do that incredibly well. And we'll see incredible numbers when Mitt Romney and Barack Obama stand on a stage together. And I wondered if that's really sort of taken part of the place of the conventions, Julian?
There's there's certainly something to that, although the debates themselves are a bit of an infomercial, some think, simply in that they become so scripted and soundbited. That said, I don't think they take away the convention. I think the basic point that we have this electorate that doesn't pay attention to politics, that so many people don't vote, they don't follow it until the summer months, this is a kickoff to the rest of the campaign, and it's a setup for the debates. I think there's something to the fact that this creates the context, the infomercial creates the context for the discussions that we're going to have over the next few months. And again, they could be drastically changed, cut down, and there's a lot of problems with them, but I still think that is a way in which the two go together.
I will add that last go round, when the debates came up and the networks had decided not very many people are going to be interested, so we're going to sort of cover it. If we have a dog in the fight, one of our people leading, we'll cover it. However, people went looking for those debates. The cable channels had ratings through the roof. People went looking. They wanted to hear that. So that, to me, is some evidence. And maybe Michael's right that they've taken the place of the conventions, that people are looking for information at certain points. I guess it's just trying to figure out if they want it all in one package, as it has been all through the 20th century. Let's get a listen to, because it's possible to have black and white sound. This 1968 clip reminds me of that. Just a little bit of a sense of what it kind of sounded like back then, and then we'll hear a little piece of what's going on now. So here's from the 1968 Republican National Convention, where Richard Nixon eventually got the nod, and there were many other candidates on the ballot who got the votes. This is from a CBS radio broadcast, and the announcers break in occasionally.
Massachusetts casts 34 votes for Governor Rockefeller.
The unofficial count is Nixon over 300 now.
34. All 34. Michigan! Michigan casts 44 votes for their favorite son, a great American, George Romney, and 4 votes for Richard Nixon.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. That was the Republican National Convention in 1968. We can sort of see what was going on there and what folks got out of it. What did they get out of last week's RNC convention, to your eye?
They didn't get that. I think some of the excitement or the uncertainty that you just broadcast with the Republican nominees that year already happened. It happened in the primaries and the extensive primary coverage that we had with a lot of debates and a lot of campaigning, where different ideas about what the Republican Party should be were already aired. And I think in that older convention, that was part of what the excitement was about. It was real debate about the direction of the party, about the candidates, about what the platform even stood by. You don't get that anymore. So I think it primarily they got the set of arguments that Republicans are going to put forward. They got to see Mitt Romney as a speaker. They got to see what it would look like, say, in 2013 if he was president and something happened, or he was reporting the State of the Union to the nation. What would he look like? What would he sound like? What does he look like when he's being presidential? Similarly with Paul Ryan as vice president. I think those are probably the most important takeaways for people to gauge whether they liked or not. But you didn't have that same kind of debate about the party itself. That was all settled by the time the delegates reached the convention.
You know, it's interesting, Callie, to hear that cut, because that was the first convention that I went to. It was just the 68 convention. And I always tell my students that in December of 1967, December 10th of 1967, a Minnesota senator named Eugene McCarthy went to New Hampshire to declare his candidacy for the New Hampshire primary, which was to be held on March 10th. The entire New Hampshire primary began in December and ended in March. And he didn't go back for the rest of December. He came back in January. It wasn't like he went there and stayed. Now, the day after this election is over, whoever wins or whomever wins, there will be an office opened up in Iowa and an office opened up in New Hampshire for the 2016 race. And that fundamentally, the idea that the conventions could be a place where you actually went in and not knowing who the candidate was going to be, made them exciting. the truth is we knew in March of this past year. We've had to wait all of this time to have this, again, event take place. And I think that's what takes some of the fun out of it and some of the drama out of it.
My guest is Michael Goldman. He's a political strategist, and also Jason Zelizer, who is a professor of history, and Julian Zelizer. I'm so sorry, Professor Zelizer, who's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And we are talking about the relevance of conventions because we've just finished the RNC, and now we're in the middle of the DNC, talking about the relevance of conventions, their power, their impact, their meaning in today's political scene. I note that Professor Zelizer, that in the early 70s, the Democrats reformed their process for selecting a nominee and then democratized the whole system. And I want to bring this up because there's been a whole lot of discussion about whether or not the Republicans this time around, through the elite, bigfooted what the rest of the delegates and perhaps the representation, the Republicans, the rank and file Republicans wanted to see in there in the way the rules were run and then what ended up in the party platform. And you can look at that versus what happened last night at the Democratic National Convention, where they're clearly, again, from the elite, President Obama made it clear through whomever he had to make it clear to, that he wanted some changes made to that platform to reinsert God and Jerusalem. So there is some stuff going on at these conventions. Maybe that's not a surprise, but in both of these instances, this has some meaning because the platform is representative of what these parties stand for, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, the earlier part of what you were talking about were the reforms the Democrats undertook under George McGovern between 68, culminating in 72, where the primaries and caucuses were finally determined to be the way in which the nominees were selected. So that diminished the role of conventions as much as changes in the media. And the whole idea was to make it more democratic. And Republicans did follow on this. And the idea was you didn't want party bosses deciding who the nominee should be. You didn't want these decisions being made in smoke-filled rooms. You wanted actual voters to do that. And even though some Tea Party Republicans argue that this time around they were quashed, and there could be an argument, this still was settled in the primaries and caucuses, and this was the ultimate decision. More than the party platform and how that shaped, I think the other big story is obviously what's the impact of all this private money on the campaigns. That had a lot of weight in the primaries and caucuses. These independent organizations that are running ads that really helped certain candidates, and all the fundraising that's going on is probably as dramatic or vital as the debate we just saw last night over the party platform. So I think that's another way in which we can talk about whether an elite has reemerged and how they have influence.
You know, it's interesting that you make that point, because I thought it was fascinating that one of the things, if you went to the Republican convention or you watched it, they talked about taking on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. In the Democratic convention, they talked about taking on the Supreme Court and overturning Citizens United. Mm. Both parties have a different view of what the worst law is. And the reform, if you will, the idea that there was going to be caucuses and every state was going to have a primary. That's a new phenomenon. I mean, we in 1976, I worked for Mo Udall for president. Mm-hmm. Some of you may remember President Udall. He was a great president.
Right.
And and Jimmy Carter went into this place, Iowa, and we were all in New Hampshire because that's where the action was. And he went into Iowa in 76 at a caucus in which I think, if I'm right, Professor, I don't even think 6% of the Democrats in Iowa participated, and yet that became the single most important event of that cycle, drove him to 6 straight victories. The last 6 primaries of that year, Carter didn't win one of them. And so he was able to use the momentum of a new event. And I don't know how today anything like that could happen again. I don't know how you could have that kind of excitement, and money is a very big part of why institutional players hang on and win, and insurgent players, it's very difficult for them to emerge and actually beat the sort of front runner.
Let's listen to some a little clip from the 2008 Democratic National Convention. To go back to that time, there was, you know, a lot of unique aspects to that campaign, including the Barack Obama's being on the scene. So this is Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings at the convention giving an introduction, some say very long, before pledging delegates to both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Madam Chair, the great state of Maryland, the birthplace of our Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the birthplace of Harriet Tubman, and the birthplace of the Star Spangled Banner. We cast proudly our votes for two great Americans. 6 votes for Hillary Clinton, 94 votes for the next president of the United States of America.
Now, what I like about that, again, all right, this is back to the relevancy question is, you know, when people do these lead up to here are our votes from the delegates, you really get a sense of the country and where these, what each of these states represent. I find that refreshing because I don't always know. So for them to say it and say it with great pride, you know, it just makes you feel kind of, well, American. Michael Coleman.
I can't argue with that. I that's my favorite part. It always has been my favorite part of the conventions is when these guys, you know, have one moment in time. They've waited for 4 years to have the 10 seconds in the national spotlight. And it is interesting. And they always do seem to, a lot of them, take the time to sort of say something unique about their state. And it, but you got to be pretty much of a junkie to like that kind of stuff. I make fun all the time. I have a friend of mine who goes to Comic-Con. And which is a very weird thing for someone who has no interest at all in anything that goes on there. But he gets as excited about Comic-Con as I used to about the conventions. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to see his friends. You articulated it perfectly. You're going to, you know, hear things about the thing you love, politics, and you know, the way they do there. The real question is whether if we put Comic-Con on TV 1 hour for 3 nights, what the viewership would be. And I'm not sure it would be any better than the conventions. You know, it's so niched now. Again, it's kind of difficult. And I do think that the debates are going to be watched. I think people are going to pay attention because they want to take a measure of Romney, who they really are very nervous about. And they want to see if Obama wants it and is willing to be as good as he was 4 years ago. And I think he's going to be, but I think they want to see it.
So, Professor Zelizer, do you think that in 2008, the conventions, no surprise or no, were more important because of the uniqueness of Barack Obama's being a candidate than they are now?
Absolutely. I mean, Barack Obama was unique. That was a unique moment. The excitement about his candidacy, who he was, what he represented, and the possibilities he represented were something different. It wasn't your ordinary campaign. So I think more Americans were eager to tune in to every part of that campaign. You know, a moment when transcending politics seemed possible. And so I think that's different than today. There was also a lot of anger towards George W. Bush and frustration that at the same time probably drove up interest in politics. The negative is often as important as the positive. We have some of that, obviously, with opposition to President Obama, but we don't have a candidate like Barack Obama in 2008 compared to President Obama in 2012 that can generate that same level of interest.
And I would add, because I think that's a really interesting point, I do think that the thing that made the extra piece of 2008 was there was a sense of a passing generation. The decision, to my surprise, of Ted Kennedy going with Barack Obama and not with Hillary Clinton. Carolyn Kennedy talking about the fact that, you know, like the people who talk about my father, you know, she was a kid when she died. There was a real sense there was something unique and special going on that convention. And I really do think that a lot of people watched it and were inspired by it, whether they were Republicans or Democrats. I think that it was a really extraordinary moment in terms of, you know, turning into the 21st century.
Nowadays, it seems to me, and maybe this is just listening to so much analysis of both of the conventions, this is to both of you, Most people say when the folks get on the platform and start doing their great speeches or not so great speeches, they're speaking to the base. Everybody in the room is the base. And by that, it seems to suggest that the base somehow doesn't represent the rest of the body of Democrats or Republicans out in the United States. But somehow these people are very, very narrow in their support of the Democratic or the Republican Party, so that you almost have to, according to some, dismiss their response to certain issues that are raised by the speakers, which is a little bit odd. And it came up actually both of the conventions. So at the Republican convention, the question is, are the people who are speaking or making the biggest splash speaking for themselves and looking forward and not representing Romney's best interests? And there's a tension there between Romney, the perceived moderate still, and others who from the Tea Party not quite trust him. In the Democratic Party, is Elizabeth Warren speaking to the liberal wing, and President Clinton is speaking to the centrist wing, and there's a tension there about who really represents the Democrats. A wondering Professor Zelizer, how do you feel about it? What do you think about that? Do the delegates now these days really represent the people who are Democrats or the people who are Republicans?
Well, the delegates represent the party, and that's what they're meant to do. And the fact is that in a very polarized electorate, what candidates count on are the loyal party members to get people enthused, to get people organized, to get people out there. And so you do speak about the issues that most inspire the most active members of parties and primaries and caucuses. And even into the election, the active party member is still extraordinarily important in making sure that that candidate does well on election day. The trouble is, the candidates do have to also appeal, especially in this election, to this sliver of moderates or so-called independents who are undecided or who could be swayed. And then Bill Clinton is someone who really believes in that small fraction and how they can determine the election. And sometimes the messages that the candidates and the politicians have to convey are contradictory or they are at odds. But still, even if you heard what Bill Clinton was saying and you heard what most of the other Democrats have been saying, they have found pretty much a unifying message about the middle class, about the need to maintain some kind of social provision, just as Republicans did. And so those divisions are there, but I don't think, they rip apart the party. And I think there's enough commonality for them to speak about.
I a little bit different than you on that. I'm always interested in seeing the Pew surveys of the delegates to the Republican and Democratic national conventions and how different they are than the party at large. The Republicans are always further to the right than Republican mainstream voters, and the Democrats are always further to the left. I really do believe, it was a little bit weird, for Democrats to see people booing the God plank, even though anyone who's actually read the platform knows that it's full of religious
references.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Israel's concerned, Jerusalem, I think that 95% of the Democrats that I know think that Jerusalem, if Israel wants it to be the capital, that's fine. If Palestine wants it to be the capital, that's fine. That's not what I care about. I care about jobs. And yet, in that little tiny room, you saw sort of the extremism play out. You saw it in the Republican convention when Romney never mentioned certain kinds of things that convention would have liked to have heard about. He did not say that DOMA ought to be held sacrosanct, that Bill Clinton gave it to us and we ought to keep it. Even though the people in that room would have loved to have heard that, the Defense of Marriage Act. And the truth is that the sliver is exactly the right word. Right now we have 10 states, probably 120,000 people out there out of the millions who are going to vote, who are going to actually decide this election. And none of them are partisan Republicans or Democrats. You got to talk to them.
At these conventions, have there been, can you recall Professor Zelizer, Julian Zelizer at Princeton University, any deal-breaking conventions, the colorful ones that, made some big shifts, whether in that moment or right after?
Well, you have tons. I mean, in 1952, you had brokered conventions where The outcome of the nominee was really decided at the convention in 1968. The Democratic convention is famous in Chicago, not because of the nominee being selected, but the anti-war protest that took place outside the convention about the war plank, about Hubert Humphrey, about support for Eugene McCarthy. And symbolically, it was very important. 64, Republicans meet, and Barry Goldwater delivers the famous speech that we've heard about extremism. And while Goldwater goes down to defeat in a landslide election against Lyndon Johnson, his message resonates and inspires many conservatives for years to come. One last one is in 1980, when Ted Kennedy loses to Jimmy Carter in the primaries, but delivers a very powerful speech. And the delegates like his speech more than Carter, and it represents a real rift between liberals and a more centrist part of the Democratic Party. So there's not always deal breakers, but there are many historic moments where you could really see a way in which the party is moving or the ways in which a party is being torn apart at these conventions.
You know, John Kennedy's famous line from 1960 was, "If it gets to the back room, I ain't going to be the candidate." and you don't have that kind of dynamic anymore, because we know going in. But it's funny. I worked for, no great surprise, being a Massachusetts guy, I worked for Teddy Kennedy in 1980, proudly. And down at that convention, you may remember, he gave a speech, and the one thing that President Carter wanted was to have Teddy raise his hand. They put all the candidates on the stage together, and Teddy ducked and dove and did everything he could. It's my favorite moment of my entire career. We're watching, we're laughing, he's running, and that was a great moment at a convention that, you know, a lot of people don't even know took place. It was fabulous to have been there to see that.
Well, speaking of connectiveness, everybody wanted to see, or somebody made sure they saw, President Clinton and President Obama in the big, you know, bro man hug. That was important, Michael Goldman, political consultant, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody knows that. Barack Obama ran against the guy's wife. You know, I mean, you know, there's a lot of feelings out there. And no matter how much they work together, there really is a sense among a lot of Democrats still that she was the better candidate. And it was her time for a woman, if you will. And he outplayed her and he won. And they still have dreams, I think, about 2016. But Bill Clinton, for the very reason that Julian just said, he's the guy who's going to get that 120,000 voters in those 10 states to say, let's give Obama a second chance. He's the guy who they believe when he says it was much worse when he took over than I did. It's one thing for Obama to say that. It's another thing for Clinton to say that. And there is a synergy there, and it's really kind of funny to see it. But in politics, sometimes the guy you're opposed to one cycle is the guy you need to get elected the next cycle. And we saw that, I think, last night. And Clinton loved it. Clinton loved it.
Yes.
And I'm sure Obama would have liked to have not needed his former opponent's husband. But, you know, he wants to win, and that's what you do.
What do you think, Professor Zelizer?
No, absolutely. It was a very significant moment. That relationship has been interesting from the start, both in 2008 with the tensions that emerged, and then Obama, you know, selecting many of Clinton's people to help him with the economy. It's always been this interesting relationship, but he needs Bill Clinton. Clinton can reach those voters very effectively. It was a very powerful speech in making the case for Barack Obama, making it almost a cliffhanger that you want to kind of tune in again for 4 years to see how this turns out. And that's a case, ironically, the president hasn't really made. That not just there has been some progress, but we're on the cusp of something much better.
You might,
and I think it was an effective speech, and seeing them together has a kind of unifying feeling or symbolism for the party.
I agree with that. I was just going to say, it's kind of funny to be a Democratic consultant and be, you know, somebody who cares about the party and know that Clinton, who is, you know, let's face it, the big foot in the party, that he has a closer relationship with George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush than he does with my president.
Yeah,
it is sort of a weird sort of dynamic, but that's what happens. And again, that's the Bill Clinton magic. And, you know, Barack Obama, to me, has been a much, much better president than people give him credit for. I didn't agree with the decision he made to wait as long as he did to see that the Republicans weren't going to work with him. But I like the idea that he thought that he could do it, that he could actually, you know, by the force of his own personality and his will, that he could actually get people to sit at a table. Those days probably are gone now, unfortunately, and that's sad. But I don't mind the fact that he tried, and I wouldn't have minded if a Republican tried and the Democrats sort of gave him the high hat.
We know that one thing that these conventions do, if nothing else, even if there's no surprise, for the beyond the president, but the A-list tier of people, it's a chance for them to make themselves known. So we see from the Republican National Convention, Maya Love, black woman, Mormon, running for Congress. I mean, you can't say any more than that in terms of support of Romney. We see here at the Democratic National Convention, Julian Castro. But we also saw Elizabeth Warren on the stage. And so I want to bring it a little bit closer to home, Michael Goldman, and say, did she distinguish herself on the national stage there, or did she just do well for herself for Massachusetts?
I think that speech was about something that was a little different. And again, I'd be interested to see if the professor sees this differently. I saw her speech as the mano a mano, to sort of mix my metaphors there a little bit, a speech to Christie's. Christie's, as governor, got a lot of criticism because he used the word I a lot in his speech. The reason he used I a lot in his speech was that he really didn't have a relationship with Romney. He was talking about Republican values, but basically there was no place for him to say, when Mitt and I stood together on the front lines and fought, you know, for peace, love, and brotherhood.
Well, wait a minute. Let me just interrupt you just one second and say, I'm not a political consultant, but I could have said it with his speech, hey, I worked with the unions and the legislature, and you know where I got that from if I'm Chris Christie? I got it from Mitt Romney. He worked with the Democratic legislature. He doesn't have to know him to say that.
Yeah, except that that's not the message you want to give to Republicans who don't like unions and don't like the fact that Mitt Romney was governor. Remember, Mitt Romney didn't talk about being governor of Massachusetts at the convention. The other part of that is her speech allowed her to do something that he couldn't, and that is to say, the president called on me to go down there to fight for an issue that we both cared about. We fought in the trenches together. He backed me up 100%, and we were successful. That was a great narrative that she got to do that Christie couldn't, and I think in that regard she was effective. Do I think that it changed the vote in Massachusetts? I think when she stands on the stage, Callie, with Scott Brown, you know, that's when she's going to make her case as to whether she can make the case that he's been a lousy senator and she understands the problems of people like them. So I think there were two separate things. I think she did fine, but I don't think it changed anything in Massachusetts.
So, Professor, I'm really interested in your take because you don't have a dog in this fight, as we say.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, it was effective, relatively effective as a speech, not only for President Obama, but to set up Bill Clinton and to set up the arguments of the night about an administration committed to fighting for the middle class, spoken from someone who did it for the president rather than someone who's just endorsing the president. So I think that worked, but I'm not convinced that's going to play in Massachusetts. You know, if anything, Brown might be able to turn it against her and you know, use it to tag her as too left of center, or it just might not play when compared to the candidate she's up against. There's just two different venues, and I'm not sure this national exposure is going to, you know, be a turning point in this race that we're watching in Massachusetts.
Well, we'll leave it there. Want to know from you, Professor, will you be watching in 2016? Will any of us? Will there be a convention?
I think we will be. I think it might be shorter for many reasons, including budgetary, but we'll still be watching.
All righty. We've been talking about party conventions, how they've changed and why they still matter. I've been speaking with Michael Goldman and Julian Zelizer. Michael Goldman is a political strategist, and Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Here comes Edgar Herwick into Studio 3 with a grin on his face.
Hey, Callie. So I know you're a supporter of and a lover of the arts. So do me a favor. Can you name me three of the arts? Any three.
Dance, painting, theater.
All right. There you go. How long do you think we would go until you got down to sketch comedy?
A long way. Yeah, it can be artful, but it's not fine art.
I think a lot of people feel that way. Well, this week, Improv Boston has gathered sketch, improv, stand-up acts from all around the country. They've got festivals of shows and workshops that are dedicated to the art of comedy.
Well, this will be interesting to hear about.
All right, good.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.